Side 1. Good Omens, the Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch, by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Copyright 1990, by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Bohemian Rhapsody, by Freddie Mercury. Copyright 1975, B. Feldman and Company Limited, trading as Trident Music. Narrated by Jack Carroll. This book contains 354 pages on 10 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. Armageddon is scheduled for next Saturday, but Demon Crowley and Angel Azrael are not looking forward to it. In order to prevent this, they must kill the Antichrist, who lives on Earth as a young child. However, there is a problem. Three children were switched at birth, and no one knows which one is the Antichrist. Violence and Some Strong Language, 1990. From the Book Jacket. According to the Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, the world's only totally reliable guide to the future, the world will end on a Saturday. Next Saturday, in fact. Just before dinner. Which means that Armageddon will happen on Saturday night. There will be seas of fire, rains of fish, the moon turning to blood, and the massed armies of heaven and hell will sort it all out once and for all. Which is a major problem for Crowley, hell's most approachable demon and former serpent, and his opposite number and old friend, Azrael, genuine angel and London bookshop owner. They like it down here, or in Crowley's case, up here. So they've got no alternative but to stop the four motorcyclists of the apocalypse, defeat the marching ranks of the Witchfinder army, note, all two of them, end note, and somehow stop it all from happening. Above all, or in Azrael's case, below all, they need to find and kill the Antichrist, currently the most powerful creature on Earth. This is a shame, because he's 11 years old, loves his dog, even though it's really a satanic hellhound under all that hair, really cares about the environment, and is the sort of boy anyone would be proud to have as a son. He's also totally invulnerable and a nice kid. And if that isn't enough, they've still got Sunday to deal with. About the author. For those who really need to know, Terry Pratchett was born in Buckinghamshire, England, in 1948. He has managed to avoid all the really interesting jobs authors take in order to look good in this kind of biography. In his search for a quiet life, he got a job as a press officer with the Central Electricity Generating Board just after Three Mile Island, which shows his unerring sense of timing. Now a full-time writer, he lives in Somerset with his wife and daughter. He likes people to buy him banana daiquiris. He knows people don't read author biographies, but feels this might be worth a try. Neil Gaiman used to be a journalist, but gave it all up to write comics, which he claims are a totally valid late 20th century art form. And he's even won awards for them, so that's all right. He's 5 feet 11 inches tall, owns a number of black t-shirts, and although he's not overly keen on banana daiquiris, is always very flattered when appreciative fans send him money. He's read Terry Pratchett's biography, and although he doubts that this will have any effect, figures, what the hell? Caveat. Kids, bringing about Armageddon can be dangerous. Do not attempt it in your own home. Dedication. The authors would like to join the Demon Crowley in dedicating this book to the memory of G.K. Chesterton, a man who knew what was going on. In the beginning. It was a nice day. All the days had been nice. There had been rather more than 7 of them so far, and rain hadn't been invented yet. But clouds massing east of Eden suggested that the first thunderstorm was on its way, and it was going to be a big one. The angel of the eastern gate put his wings over his head to shield himself from the first drops. "I'm sorry," he said politely. "What was it you were saying?"
"I said that one went down like a lead balloon," said the serpent.
"Oh, yes," said the angel, whose name was Aziraphale.
"I think it was a bit of an overreaction, to be honest," said the serpent. "I mean, first offense and everything. I can't see what's so bad about knowing the difference between good and evil anyway."
"It must be bad," reasoned Aziraphale, in the slightly concerned tones of one who can't see it either, and is worrying about it. "Otherwise, you wouldn't have been involved."
"They just said, 'Get up there and make some trouble,'" said the serpent, whose name was Crawley, although he was thinking of changing it now.
Crawley, he decided, was not him.
"Yes, but you're a demon. I'm not sure if it's actually possible for you to do good," said Aziraphale. "It's down to your basic, you know, nature. Nothing personal, you understand."
"You've got to admit it's a bit of a pantomime, though," said Crawley. "I mean, pointing out the tree and saying, 'Don't touch,' in big letters. Not very subtle, is it? I mean, why not put it on top of a high mountain or a long way off?
Makes you wonder what he's really planning."
"Best not to speculate, really," said Aziraphale. "You can't second-guess ineffability, I always say. There's right, and there's wrong. If you do wrong when you're told to do right, you deserve to be punished.
They sat in embarrassed silence, watching the raindrops bruise the first flowers.
Eventually, Crawley said, "Didn't you have a flaming sword?"
Said the angel.
A guilty expression passed across his face, and then came back and camped there.
"You did, didn't you?" said Crawley. "It flamed like anything."
Well,
it looked very impressive, I thought.
"Yes, but, well,
lost it, have you?"
"Oh, no. No, not exactly lost, more..."
"Well?"
Aziraphale looked wretched.
"If you must know," he said, a trifle testily, "I gave it away."
Crawley stared up at him.
"Well, I had to," said the angel, rubbing his hands distractedly. "They look so cold, poor things, and she's expecting already. And what with the vicious animals out there, and the storm coming up, I thought, well, where's the harm? So I just said, 'Look, if you come back, there's going to be an almighty row. But you might be needing this sword, so here it is. Don't bother to thank me. Just do everyone a big favor, and don't let the sun go down on you here.'"
He gave Crawley a worried grin.
"That was the best course, wasn't it?"
"I'm not sure it's actually possible for you to do evil," said Crawley sarcastically.
Aziraphale didn't notice the tone.
"Oh, I do hope so," he said. "I really do hope so. It's been worrying me all afternoon."
They watched the rain for a while.
"Funny thing is," said Crawley, "I keep wondering whether the apple thing wasn't the right thing to do as well. A demon can get into real trouble doing the right thing."
He nudged the angel.
"Funny if we both got it wrong, eh? Funny if I did the good thing and you did the bad one, eh?"
"Not really," said Aziraphale.
Crawley looked at the rain.
"No," he said, sobering up. "I suppose not.
slate-black curtains tumbled over Eden. Thunder growled among the hills. The animals, freshly named, cowered from the storm. Far away in the dripping woods, something bright and fiery flickered among the trees. It was going to be a dark and stormy night. Good Omens, a narrative of certain events occurring in the last 11 years of human history, in strict accordance as shall be shown with the nice and accurate prophecies of Agnes Nutter. Compiled and edited with footnotes of an educational nature and precepts for the wise by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Dramatis Personae. Supernatural beings. God. God. Metatron. The voice of God. Azrael. An angel and part-time rare book dealer. Satan, a fallen angel, the adversary. Beelzebub, a likewise fallen angel and prince of hell. Hastur, a fallen angel and duke of hell. Liger, likewise a fallen angel and duke of hell. Crowley, an angel who did not so much fall as saunter vaguely downwards. Apocalyptic horse persons. Death. Death. War. War. Famine. Famine. Pollution. Pollution. Humans. Thou shalt not commit adultery, Pulsifer. A witch finder. Agnes Nutter. A prophetess. Newton Pulsifer. Wages clerk and witch-finder private. Anathema device. Practical occultist and professional descendant. Shadwell. Witch-finder sergeant. Madam Tracy. Painted Jezebel. Mornings only. Thursdays by arrangement. And medium. Sister Mary Loquacious. A satanic nun of the Chattering Order of St. Beryl. Mr. Young, a father. Mr. Tyler, a chairman of a residence association. A delivery man. Them. Adam, an antichrist. Pepper, a girl. Wensleydale, a boy. Brian, a boy. Full chorus of Tibetans, aliens, Americans, Atlanteans, and other rare and strange creatures of the last days. And dog, satanical hellhound, and cat warrior. 11 years ago. Current theories on the creation of the universe state that if it was created at all and didn't just start, as it were, unofficially, it came into being between 10 and 20,000 million years ago. By the same token, the Earth itself is generally supposed to be about 4,500 million years old. These dates are incorrect. Medieval Jewish scholars put the date of the creation at 3,760 BC. Greek Orthodox theologians put creation as far back as 5,508 B.C. These suggestions are also incorrect. Archbishop James Usher, 1580 to 1656, published Annales Veteris et Novi Testamenti in 1654, which suggested that the heaven and the earth were created in 4,004 B.C. One of his aides took the calculation further and was able to announce triumphantly that the earth was created on Sunday, the 21st of October, 4004 B.C., at exactly 9 a.m., because God liked to get work done early in the morning while he was feeling fresh. This, too, was incorrect, by almost a quarter of an hour. The whole business with the fossilized dinosaur skeletons was a joke the paleontologists haven't seen yet. This proves two things. Firstly, that God moves in extremely mysterious, not to say circuitous ways. God does not play dice with the universe. He plays an ineffable game of his own devising, which might be compared, from the perspective of any of the other players, note, that is, everybody, end note, to being involved in an obscure and complex version of poker in a pitch-dark room with blank cards for infinite stakes with a dealer who won't tell you the rules and who smiles all the time. Secondly, the Earth's a Libra. The astrological prediction for Libra in the Your Stars Today column of the Tadfield Advertiser, on the day this history begins, read as follows. Libra, 24 September to 23 October. You may be feeling run down and always in the same old daily round. Home and family matters are highlighted and are hanging fire. Avoid unnecessary risks. A friend is important to you. Shelve major decisions until the way ahead seems clear. You may be vulnerable to a stomach upset today, so avoid salads. Help could come from an unexpected quarter. This was perfectly correct on every count, except for the bit about the salads. It wasn't a dark and stormy night. It should have been, but that's the weather for you. For every mad scientist who's had a convenient thunderstorm just on the night his great work is finished and lying on the slab, there have been dozens who've sat around aimlessly under the peaceful stars while Igor clocks up the overtime. But don't let the fog, with rain later, temperatures dropping to around 45 degrees, give anyone a false sense of security. Just because it's a mild night doesn't mean that dark forces aren't abroad. They're abroad all the time. They're everywhere. They always are. That's the whole point. Two of them worked in the ruined graveyard. Two shadowy figures, one hunched and squat, the other lean and menacing. Both of them Olympic-grade lurkers. If Bruce Springsteen had ever recorded Born to Lurk, these two would have been on the album cover. They had been lurking in the fog for an hour now, but they had been pacing themselves and could lurk for the rest of the night if necessary, with still enough sullen menace left for a final burst of lurking around dawn. Finally, after another 20 minutes, one of them said, "Bugger this for a lark. He should have been here hours ago." The speaker's name was Haster. He was a Duke of Hell. Many phenomena, wars, plagues, sudden audits, have been advanced as evidence for the hidden hand of Satan in the affairs of man. But whenever students of demonology get together, the M25 London Orbital Motorway is generally agreed to be among the top contenders for Exhibit A. Where they go wrong, of course, is in assuming that the wretched road is evil simply because of the incredible carnage and frustration it engenders every day. In fact, very few people on the face of the planet know that the very shape of the M25 forms the sigil Odegra in the language of the black priesthood of ancient Mu, and means, "Hail the great beast, devourer of worlds." The thousands of motorists who daily fume their way around its serpentine lengths have the same effect as water on a prayer wheel, grinding out an endless fog of low-grade evil to pollute the metaphysical atmosphere for scores of miles around. It was one of Crowley's better achievements. It had taken years to achieve, and had involved 3 computer hacks, 2 break-ins, 1 minor bribery, and, on one wet night when all else had failed, 2 hours in a squelchy field, shifting the marker pegs a few but occultly incredibly significant meters. When Crowley had watched the first 30-mile-long tailback, he'd experienced the lovely, warm feeling of a bad job well done. It had earned him a commendation. Crowley was currently doing 110 miles per hour somewhere east of Slough. Nothing about him looked particularly demonic, at least by classical standards. No horns, no wings. Admittedly, he was listening to a Best of Queen tape, but no conclusion should be drawn from this, because all tapes left in a car for more than about a fortnight metamorphose into Best of Queen albums. No particularly demonic thoughts were going through his head. In fact, he was currently wondering vaguely who Moe and Shandon were. Crowley had dark hair and good cheekbones, and he was wearing snakeskin shoes. Or at least, presumably, he was wearing shoes. And he could do really weird things with his tongue. And whenever he forgot himself, he had a tendency to hiss. He also didn't blink much. The car he was driving was a 1926 black Bentley, one owner from New, and that owner had been Crowley. He looked after it. The reason he was late was that he was enjoying the 20th century immensely. It was much better than the 17th, and a lot better than the 14th. One of the nice things about time, Crowley always said, was that it was steadily taking him further away from the 14th century. The most bloody, boring 100 years on God's, excuse his French, earth. The 20th century was anything but boring. In fact, a flashing blue light in his rearview mirror had been telling Crowley for the last 50 seconds that he was being followed by two men who would like to make it even more interesting for him. He glanced at his watch, which was designed for the kind of rich deep-sea diver who likes to know what the time is in 21 world capitals while he's down there. Note, it was custom-made for Crowley. Getting just one chip custom-made is incredibly expensive, but he could afford it. This watch gave the time in 20 world capitals and in a capital city in another place, where it was always one time, and that was too late. End note. The Bentley thundered up the exit ramp, took the corner on two wheels, and plunged down a leafy road. The blue light followed. Crowley sighed, took one hand from the wheel, and, half-turning, made a complicated gesture over his shoulder. The flashing light dimmed into the distance as the police car rolled to a halt, much to the amazement of its occupants. But it would be nothing to the amazement they'd experience when they opened the hood and found out what the engine had turned into. In the graveyard, Haster, the tall demon, passed the dog end back to Liger, the shorter one and the more accomplished lurker. "I can see a light," he said. "Here he comes now, the flash bastard."
"What's that he's driving?"
said Liger. "It's a car, a horseless carriage," explained Haster. "I expect they didn't have them last time you was here. Not for what you might call general use."
"They had a man at the front with a red flag," said Liger.
"They've come on a bit since then, I reckon."
"What's this Crowley like?" said Liger.
Haster spat. "He's been up here too long," he said. "Right from the start. Gone native, if you ask me. Drives a car with a telephone in it."
Liger pondered this. Like most demons, he had a very limited grasp of technology, and so he was just about to say something like, "I bet it needs a lot of wire," when the Bentley rolled to a halt at the cemetery gate.
"And he wears sunglasses," sneered Haster. "Even when he don't need to." He raised his voice. "All hail Satan," he said.
"All hail Satan,"
Liger echoed.
"Hi,"
said Crowley, giving them a little wave. "Sorry I'm late, but you know how it is on the A40 at Denham. And then I tried to cut up towards Charlie Wood, and then..."
"Now we art all here,"
said Haster meaningfully. We must recount the deeds of the day.
Yeah, deeds, said Crowley, with the slightly guilty look of one who is attending church for the first time in years and has forgotten which bitch you stand up for.
Haster cleared his throat. I have tempted a priest, he said, as he walked down the street and saw the pretty girls in the sun. I put doubt into his mind. He would have been a saint, but within a decade we shall have him.
Nice one, said Crowley, helpfully.
I have corrupted a politician, said Liger. I let him think a tiny bribe would not hurt. Within a year we shall have him.
They both looked expectantly at Crowley, who gave them a big smile.
You like this, he said. His smile became even wider and more conspiratorial. I tied up every portable telephone system in central London for 45 minutes at lunchtime, he said. There was silence, except for the distant swishing of cars.
Yes, said Haster.
And then what?
Look, it wasn't easy, said Crowley.
That's all? Said Liger.
Look, people.
And exactly what has that done to secure souls for our master? Said Haster.
Crowley pulled himself together.
What could he tell them? That 20,000 people got bloody furious? That you could hear the arteries clanging shut all across the city? And that then they went back and took it out on their secretaries or traffic wardens or whatever, and they took it out on other people? In all kinds of vindictive little ways, which, and here was the good bit, they thought up themselves. For the rest of the day, the pass-along effects were incalculable. Thousands and thousands of souls all got a faint patina of tarnish, and you hardly had to lift a finger. But you couldn't tell that to demons like Haster and Liger. 14th-century minds, the lot of them. Spending years picking away at one soul. Admittedly, it was craftsmanship. But you had to think differently these days. Not big, but wide. With 5 billion people in the world, you couldn't pick the buggers off one by one anymore. You had to spread your effort. But demons like Liger and Haster wouldn't understand. They'd never have thought up Welsh language television, for example, or value-added tax, or Manchester. He'd been particularly pleased with Manchester. The powers that be seem to be satisfied, he said. Times are changing. So, what's up? Haster reached down behind a tombstone. This is, he said. Crowley stared at the basket. Oh, he said. No.
Yes, said Haster, grinning.
Already?
Yes.
And, it's up to me to...
Yes.
Haster was enjoying this.
Why me? Said Crowley desperately. You know me, Haster. This isn't, you know... my scene.
Oh, it is, said Haster. Your scene, your starring role. Take it. Times are changing.
Yeah, said Liger, grinning. They're coming to an end for a start. Why me?
You are obviously highly favored, said Haster maliciously. I imagine Liger here would give his right arm for a chance like this.
That's right, said Liger.
Someone's right arm, anyway, he thought. There were plenty of right arms around. No sense in wasting a good one.
Haster produced a clipboard from the grubby recesses of his Mac.
Sign. Here, he said, leaving a terrible pause between the words.
Crowley fumbled vaguely in an inside pocket and produced a pen. It was sleek and matte black. It looked as though it could exceed the speed limit.
"It's a nice pen,"
said Liger. "It can write underwater," Crowley muttered.
"Whatever will they think of next?" mused Liger.
"Whatever it is, they'd better think of it quickly," said Haster. "No, not A.J. Crowley. Your real name."
Crowley nodded mournfully and drew a complex, wiggly sigil on the paper. It glowed redly in the gloom, just for a moment, and then faded.
"What am I supposed to do with it?" he said.
"You will receive instructions," Haster scowled. "Why so worried, Crowley? The moment we have been working for all these centuries is at hand."
"Yeah, right," said Crowley. He did not look now like the lithe figure that had sprung so lithely from the Bentley a few minutes ago. He had a hunted expression.
"Our moment of eternal triumph awaits."
"Eternal, yeah," said Crowley.
"And you will be a tool of that glorious destiny."
"Tool, yeah," muttered Crowley. He picked up the basket as if it might explode, which, in a manner of speaking, it would shortly do.
Okay, he said. "I'll, be off then. Shall I? Get it over with. Not that I want to get it over with," he added hurriedly,
aware of the things that could happen if Haster turned in an unfavorable report. "But you know me, keen." The senior demons did not speak.
"So I'll be popping along," Crowley babbled. "See you guys are..."
"See you."
"Great. Fine. Ciao."
As the Bentley skidded off into the darkness, Liger said,
"What's that mean?"
"It's Italian," said Haster. "I think it means food."
"Funny thing to say, then."
Liger stared at the retreating taillights.
"You trust him?"
he said.
"No," said Haster.
"Right,"
said Liger. It'd be a funny old world, he reflected, if demons went round trusting one another. Crowley, somewhere west of Amersham, hurtled through the night, snatched a tape at random, and tried to wrestle it out of its brittle plastic box while staying on the road. The glare of a headlight proclaimed it to be Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Soothing music. That's what he needed. He rammed it into the Blaupunkt.
"Oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit! Why now? Why me?" he muttered, as the familiar strains of Queen washed over him.
And suddenly, Freddie Mercury was speaking to him.
"Because you've earned it, Crowley."
Crowley blessed under his breath. Using electronics as a means of communication had been his idea, and Below had, for once, taken it up, and as usual, got it dead wrong. He'd hoped they could be persuaded to subscribe to Cellnet, but instead, they just cut into whatever it happened to be that he was listening to at the time, and twisted it. Crowley gulped.
"Thank you very much, Lord," he said. "We have great faith in you, Crowley."
"Thank you, Lord."
"This is important, Crowley."
"I know, I know."
"This is the big one, Crowley."
"Leave it to me, Lord."
"That is what we are doing, Crowley. And if it goes wrong, then those involved will suffer greatly. Even you, Crowley. Especially you."
"Understood, Lord."
"Here are your instructions, Crowley."
And suddenly he knew. He hated that. They could just as easily have told him. They didn't suddenly have to drop chilly knowledge straight into his brain. He had to drive to a certain hospital.
"I'll be there in 5 minutes, Lord. No problem."
"Good.
I see a little silhouetto of a man, Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Crowley thumped the wheel. Everything had been going so well.
He'd had it really under his thumb these few centuries.
That's how it goes. You think you're on top of the world, and suddenly, they spring Armageddon on you. The Great War. The last battle. Heaven versus hell. Three rounds, one fall, no submission. And that'd be that. No more world. That's what the end of the world meant. No more world. Just endless heaven. Or, depending who won, endless hell.
Crowley didn't know which was worse.
Well, hell was worse, of course, by definition.
But Crowley remembered what heaven was like, and it had quite a few things in common with hell. You couldn't get a decent drink in either of them, for a start. And the boredom you got in heaven was almost as bad as the excitement you got in hell.
But there was no getting out of it. You couldn't be a demon and have free will.
I will not let you go. Let him go.
Well, at least it wouldn't be this year. He'd have time to do things. Unload long-term stocks for a start.
He wondered what would happen if he just stopped the car here on this dark and damp and empty road and took the basket and swung it round and round and let go and...
something dreadful, that's what.
He'd been an angel once. He hadn't meant to fall. He'd just hung around with the wrong people.
The Bentley plunged on through the darkness, its fuel gauge pointing to zero. It had pointed to zero for more than 60 years now. It wasn't all bad being a demon. You didn't have to buy petrol, for one thing. The only time Crowley had bought petrol was once in 1967, to get the free James Bond bullet hole in the windscreen transfers, which he rather fancied at the time. On the back seat, the thing in the basket began to cry, the air raid siren wail of the newly born, high, wordless, and old.
It was quite a nice hospital, thought Mr. Young. It would have been quiet, too, if it wasn't for the nuns. He quite liked nuns. Not that he was a, you know, left-footer or anything like that. No, when it came to avoiding going to church, the church he stolidly avoided going to was St. Cecil and All Angels. No nonsense C of E, and he wouldn't have dreamed of avoiding going to any other. All the others had the wrong smell. Floor polish for the low, somewhat suspicious incense for the high. Deep in the leather armchair of his soul, Mr. Young knew that God got embarrassed at that sort of thing. But he liked seeing nuns around, in the same way that he liked seeing the Salvation Army. It made you feel that it was all right, that people somewhere were keeping the world on its axis. This was his first experience of the Chattering Order of St. Beryl, however. Note, St. Beryl Articulatus of Krakow, reputed to have been martyred in the middle of the 5th century. According to legend, Beryl was a young woman who was betrothed against her will to a pagan, Prince Casimir. On their wedding night, she prayed to the Lord to intercede, vaguely expecting a miraculous beard to appear, and she had in fact already laid in a small ivory-handled razor, suitable for ladies, against this very eventuality. Instead, the Lord granted Beryl the miraculous ability to chatter continually about whatever was on her mind, however inconsequential, without pause for breath or food. According to one version of the legend, Beryl was strangled by Prince Casimir 3 weeks after the wedding, with their marriage still unconsummated. She died a virgin and a martyr, chattering to the end. According to another version of the legend, Casimir bought himself a set of earplugs, and she died in bed with him at the age of 62. The Chattering Order of St. Beryl is under a vow to emulate St. Beryl at all times. except on Tuesday afternoons, for half an hour, when the nuns are permitted to shut up, and, if they wish, to play table tennis. End note. Deirdre had run across them while being involved in one of her causes, possibly the one involving lots of unpleasant South Americans fighting other unpleasant South Americans, and the priests egging them on instead of getting on with proper priestly concerns, like organizing the church cleaning rota. The point was, nuns should be quiet. They were the right shape for it, like those pointy things you got in those chambers Mr. Young was vaguely aware your hi-fi got tested in. They shouldn't be, well, chattering all the time. He filled his pipe with tobacco. Well, they called it tobacco. It wasn't what he thought of as tobacco. It wasn't the tobacco you used to get. And wondered reflectively what would happen if you asked a nun where the gents was. Probably the Pope sent you a sharp note or something. He shifted his position awkwardly and glanced at his watch. One thing, though. At least the nuns had put their foot down about him being present at the birth. Deirdre had been all for it. She'd been reading things again. One kid already, and suddenly she's declaring that this confinement was going to be the most joyous and sharing experience two human beings could have. That's what came of letting her order her own newspapers. Mr. Young distrusted papers whose inner pages had names like Lifestyle or Options. Well, he hadn't got anything against joyous sharing experiences. Joyous sharing experiences were fine by him. The world probably needed more joyous sharing experiences. But he had made it abundantly clear that this was one joyous sharing experience Deirdre could have by herself. And the nuns had agreed. They saw no reason for the father to be involved in the proceedings. When you thought about it, Mr. Young mused, they probably saw no reason why the father should be involved anywhere. He finished thumbing the so-called tobacco into the pipe and glared at the little sign on the wall of the waiting room that said that, for his own comfort, he would not smoke. For his own comfort, he decided, he'd go and stand in the porch. If there was a discreet shrubbery for his own comfort out there, so much the better. He wandered down the empty corridors and found a doorway that led out onto a rain-swept courtyard full of righteous dustbins. He shivered and cupped his hands to light his pipe. It happened to them at a certain age, wives. 25 blameless years. Then suddenly they were going off and doing these robotic exercises in pink socks with the feet cut out, and they started blaming you for never having had to work for a living. It was hormones or something. A large black car skidded to a halt by the dustbins. A young man in dark glasses leaped out into the drizzle, holding what looked like a carry cot, and snaked toward the entrance. Mr. Young took his pipe out of his mouth. "You've left your lights on," he said helpfully. The man gave him the blank look of someone to whom lights are the least of his worries, and waved a hand vaguely toward the Bentley. The lights went out. "That's handy," said Mr. Young. "Infrared, is it?" He was mildly surprised to see that the man did not appear to be wet, and that the carry cot appeared to be occupied. "Has it started yet?" said the man. Mr. Young felt vaguely proud to be so instantly recognizable as a parent. "Yes," he said. "They made me go out," he added thankfully. "Already? Any idea how long we've got?" "We," Mr. Young noted, obviously a doctor with views about co-parenting. "I think we were, getting on with it," said Mr. Young. "Which room is she in?" said the man hurriedly. "We're in room 3, said Mr. Young. He patted his pockets and found the battered packet which, in accord with tradition, he had brought with him. "Would we care to share a joyous cigar experience?" he said. But the man had gone. Mr. Young carefully replaced the packet and looked reflectively at his pipe. Always in a rush, these doctors, working all the hours God sent. There's a trick they do with one pea in three cups, which is very hard to follow, and something like it, for greater stakes than a handful of loose change, is about to take place. The text will be slowed down to allow the sleight of hand to be followed. Mrs. Deirdre Young is giving birth in delivery room 3. She is having a golden-haired male baby we will call Baby A. The wife of the American cultural attaché, Mrs. Harriet Dowling, is giving birth in delivery room 4. She is having a golden-haired male baby we will call Baby B. Sister Mary Loquacious has been a devout Satanist since birth. She went to Sabbath school as a child and won black stars for handwriting and liver. When she was told to join the Chattering Order, she went obediently, having a natural talent in that direction, and in any case, knowing that she would be among friends. She would be quite bright, if she was ever put in a position to find out, but long ago found that being a scatterbrain, as she'd put it, gave you an easier journey through life. Currently, she is being handed a golden-haired male baby we will call the adversary, destroyer of kings, angel of the bottomless pit, great beast that is called dragon, prince of this world, father of lies, spawn of Satan, and Lord of Darkness. Watch carefully. Round and round they go. "Is that him?" said Sister Mary, staring at the baby. "Only I'd expected funny eyes, red or green, or teensy-weensy little hoofikins, or a whittle tail." She turned him around as she spoke. No horns, either. The devil's child looked ominously normal. "Yes, that's him," said Crowley.
"Fancy me holding the Antichrist," said Sister Mary, "and bathing the Antichrist, and counting his little toesy-wosies."
She was now addressing the child directly, lost in some world of her own. Crowley waved a hand in front of her wimple. "Hello? Hello? Sister Mary?"
"Sorry, sir. He is a little sweetheart, though. Does he look like his daddy? I bet he does. Does he look like his daddy Redikins?"
"No," said Crowley firmly. "And now I should get up to the delivery rooms if I were you."
"Will he remember me when he grows up, do you think?"
said Sister Mary wistfully, sidling slowly down the corridor. "Pray that he doesn't," said Crowley, and fled. Sister Mary headed through the nighttime hospital with the adversary, destroyer of kings, angel of the bottomless pit, great beast that is called dragon, prince of this world, father of lies, spawn of Satan, and lord of darkness, safely in her arms. She found a bassinet and laid him down in it. He gurgled. She gave him a tickle. A matronly head appeared around the door. It said,
"Sister Mary, what are you doing here? Shouldn't you be on duty in room 4? Master Crowley said, "Just glide along. There's a good nun. Have you seen the husband anywhere? He's not in the waiting room." "I've only seen Master Crowley, and he told me..."
"I'm sure he did," said Sister Grace Voluble firmly. "I suppose I'd better go and look for the wretched man. Come in and keep an eye on her, will you? She's a bit woozy, but the baby's fine." Sister Grace paused.
"Why are you winking? Is there something wrong with your eye?" "You know," Sister Mary hissed archly, "the babies, the exchange."
Of course, in good time. But we can't have the father wandering around, can we?" said Sister Grace.
"No telling what he might see.
So just wait here and mind the baby. There's a dear." She sailed off down the polished corridor. Sister Mary, wheeling her bassinet, entered the delivery room. Mrs. Young was more than woozy. She was fast asleep, with the look of determined self-satisfaction of someone who knows that other people are going to have to do the running around for once. Baby A was asleep beside her, weighed and name-tagged. Sister Mary, who had been brought up to be helpful, removed the name tag, copied it out, and attached the duplicate to the baby in her care. The babies looked similar, both being small, blotchy, and looking sort of, though not really, like Winston Churchill. Now, thought Sister Mary, I could do with a nice cup of tea. Most of the members of the convent were old-fashioned Satanists, like their parents and grandparents before them. They'd been brought up to it and weren't, when you got right down to it, particularly evil. Human beings mostly aren't. They just get carried away by new ideas, like dressing up in jackboots and shooting people, or dressing up in white sheets and lynching people, or dressing up in tie-dye jeans and playing guitars at people. Offer people a new creed with a costume, and their hearts and minds will follow. Anyway, being brought up as a Satanist tended to take the edge off it. It was something you did on Saturday nights, and the rest of the time you simply got on with life as best you could, just like everyone else. Besides, Sister Mary was a nurse, and nurses, whatever their creed, are primarily nurses, which had a lot to do with wearing your watch upside down, keeping calm in emergencies, and dying for a cup of tea. She hoped someone would come soon. She'd done the important bit. Now she wanted her tea. It may help to understand human affairs to be clear that most of the great triumphs and tragedies of history are caused not by people being fundamentally good or fundamentally bad, but by people being fundamentally people. There was a knock at the door. She opened it. "Has it happened yet?" asked Mr. Young. "I'm the father, the husband, whatever, both." Sister Mary had expected the American cultural attaché to look like Blake Carrington or J.R. Ewing. Mr. Young didn't look like any American she'd ever seen on television, except possibly for the avuncular sheriff in The Better Class of Murder Mystery. Note: with a little old lady as the sleuth and no car chases unless they're done very slowly. End note. He was something of a disappointment. She didn't think much of his cardigan either. She swallowed her disappointment. "Oh, yes," she said. "Congratulations. Your lady wife's asleep, poor pet." Mr. Young looked over her shoulder. "Twin," he said. He reached for his pipe. He stopped reaching for his pipe. He reached for it again. "Twins? No one said anything about twins." "Oh, no," said Sister Mary hurriedly. "This one's yours. The other one's, someone else's. Just looking after him till Sister Grace gets back. No," she reiterated, pointing to the adversary, destroyer of kings, angel of the bottomless pit, great beast that is called dragon, prince of this world, father of lies, spawn of Satan, and lord of darkness. "This one's definitely yours, from the top of his head to the tips of his hoofy-woofies, which he hasn't got," she added hastily. Mr. Young peered down. "Ah, yes," he said doubtfully. "He looks like my side of the family. All, present and correct, is he?" "Oh, yes," said Sister Mary. "He's a very normal child," she added. "Very, very normal." There was a pause. They stared at the sleeping baby. "You don't have much of an accent," said Sister Mary. "Have you been over here long?" "About 10 years, said Mr. Young, mildly puzzled. "The job moved, you see, and I had to move with it." "It must be a very exciting job, I've always thought," said Sister Mary. Mr. Young looked gratified. Not everyone appreciated the more stimulating aspects of cost accountancy. "I expect it was very different where you were before," Sister Mary went on.
"I suppose so," said Mr. Young, who'd never really thought about it.
Luton, as far as he could remember, was pretty much like Tadfield. The same sort of hedges between your house and the railway station. Same sort of people. Taller buildings, for one thing, said Sister Mary desperately.
Mr. Young stared at her. The only one he could think of was the Alliance and Leicester offices.
And I expect you go to a lot of garden parties, said the nun.
Ah, he was on firmer ground here. Deirdre was very keen on that sort of thing. Lots, he said with feeling. Deirdre makes jam for them, you know. And I normally have to help with the White Elephant.
This was an aspect of Buckingham Palace society that had never occurred to Sister Mary, although the pachyderm fitted right in. I expect they're the tribute, she said. I read where these foreign potentates give her all sorts of things. I'm sorry. I'm a big fan of the royal family, you know.
Oh, so am I, said Mr. Young, leaping gratefully onto this new ice flow in the bewildering stream of consciousness. Yes, you knew where you were with the royals. The proper ones, of course, who pulled their weight in the hand-waving and bridge-opening department. Not the ones who went to discos all night long and were sick all over the paparazzi. Note,
it is possibly worth mentioning at this point that Mr. Young thought that paparazzi was a kind of Italian linoleum. End note. That's nice, said Sister Mary. I thought you people weren't too keen on them, what with revoluting and throwing all those tea sets into the river. She chattered on, encouraged by the order's instructions that members should always say what was on their minds. Mr. Young was out of his depth and too tired now to worry about it very much. The religious life probably made people a little odd. He wished Mrs. Young would wake up. Then one of the words in Sister Mary's whittering struck a hopeful chord in his mind. Would there be any possibility of me possibly being able to have a cup of tea, perhaps? He ventured. Oh, my, said Sister Mary, her hand flying to her mouth. Whatever am I thinking of? Mr. Young made no comment. I'll see to it right away, she said. Are you sure you don't want coffee, though? There's one of those vendable machines on the next floor.
Tea, please, said Mr. Young.
My word, you really have gone native, haven't you? Said Sister Mary gaily as she bustled out.
Mr. Young, left alone with one sleeping wife and two sleeping babies, sagged onto a chair.
Yes, it must be all that getting up early and kneeling and so on. Good people, of course, but not entirely compos mentis.
He'd seen a Ken Russell film once. There had been nuns in it. There didn't seem to be any of that sort of thing going on, but no smoke without fire, and so on. He sighed. It was then that baby A awoke and settled down to a really good wail. Mr. Young hadn't had to quiet a screaming baby for years. He'd never been much good at it to start with. He'd always respected Sir Winston Churchill, and patting small versions of him on the bottom had always seemed ungracious.
Welcome to the world, he said wearily. You'll get used to it after a while.
The baby shut its mouth and glared at him as if he were a recalcitrant general. Sister Mary chose that moment to come in with the tea. Satanist or not, she'd also found a plate and arranged some iced biscuits on it. They were the sort you only ever get at the bottom of certain tea-time assortments. Mr. Young's was the same pink as a surgical appliance, and had a snowman picked out on it in white icing.
I don't expect you normally have these, she said. They're what you call cookies. We call them biscuits.
Mr. Young had just opened his mouth to explain that, yes, so did he, and so did people even in Luton, when another nun rushed in, breathless. She looked at Sister Mary, realized that Mr. Young had never seen the inside of a pentagram, and confined herself to pointing at baby A and winking. Sister Mary nodded and winked back. The nun wheeled the baby out.
As methods of human communication go, a wink is quite versatile. You can say a lot with a wink. For example, the new nun's wink said, "Where the hell have you been? Baby B has been born, we're ready to make the switch, and here's you in the wrong room with the adversary destroyer of kings, angel of the bottomless pit, great beast that is called dragon, prince of this world, father of lies, spawn of Satan, and lord of darkness, drinking tea. Do you realize I've nearly been shot?" And as far as she was concerned, Sister Mary's answering wink meant, "Here's the adversary, destroyer of kings, angel of the bottomless pit, great beast that is called dragon, prince of this world, father of lies, spawn of Satan, and lord of darkness. And I can't talk now because there's this outsider here." Whereas Sister Mary, on the other hand, had thought that the orderly's wink was more in the lines of, "Well done, Sister Mary. Switched over the babies all by herself. Now, indicate to me the superfluous child, and I shall remove it and let you get on with your tea with His Royal Excellency, the American culture." And therefore her own wink had meant, "There you go, dearie. That's Baby B. Now, take him away and leave me to chat to His Excellency. I've always wanted to ask him why they have those tall buildings with all the mirrors on them." The subtleties of all this were quite lost on Mr. Young, who was extremely embarrassed at all this clandestine affection, and was thinking, "That Mr. Russell, he knew what he was talking about, and no mistake." Sister Mary's error might have been noticed by the other nun, had not she herself been severely rattled by the Secret Service man in Mrs. Dowling's room, who kept looking at her with glowing unease. This was because they had been trained to react in a certain way to people in long flowing robes and long flowing headdresses, and were currently suffering from a conflict of signals. Humans suffering from a conflict of signals aren't the best people to be holding guns, especially when they've just witnessed a natural childbirth, which definitely looked an un-American way of bringing new citizens into the world. Also, they'd heard that there were missiles in the building. Mrs. Young stirred. "Have you picked a name for him yet?" said Sister Mary archly. "Hmm," said Mr. Young. "Oh, no, not really. If it was a girl, it would have been Lucinda, after my mother. Or Germaine." That was Deirdre's choice. "Wormwood's a nice name," said the nun, remembering her classics. "Or Damien. Damien's very popular." Anathema Device, her mother, who was not a great student of religious matters, happened to read the word one day and thought it was a lovely name for a girl, was 8.5 years old, and she was reading the book under the bedclothes with a torch. Other children learned to read on basic primers with colored pictures of apples, balls, cockroaches, and so forth. Not the Device family. Anathema had learned to read from the book. It didn't have any apples and balls in it. It did have a rather good 18th century woodcut of Agnes Nutter being burned at the stake, and looking rather cheerful about it. The first word she could recognize was nice. Very few people at the age of 8.5 know that nice also means scrupulously exact. But Anathema was one of them. The second word was accurate. The first sentence she had ever read out loud was, "I tell ye this, and I charge ye with my words. 4 shall ride, and 4 shall also ride, and 3 shall ride the sky as twixt, and 1 shall ride in flames. And there shall be no stopping them, not fish, nor rain, nor road, neither devil nor angel. And ye shall be there also, Anathema." Anathema liked to read about herself. There were books which caring parents who read the right Sunday papers could purchase with their children's names printed in as the heroine or hero. This was meant to interest the child in the book. In Anathema's case, it wasn't only her in the book, and it had been spot on so far.
but her parents and her grandparents and everyone back to the 17th century. She was too young and too self-centered at this point to attach any importance to the fact that there was no mention made of her children, or indeed any events in her future, further away than 11 years' time. When you're 8 and a half, 11 years is a lifetime. And, of course, if you believe the book, it would be. She was a bright child, with a pale face and black eyes and hair. As a rule, she tended to make people feel uncomfortable, a family trait she had inherited, along with being more psychic than was good for her, from her great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. She was precocious and self-possessed. The only thing about anathema her teachers ever had the nerve to upbraid her for was her spelling, which was not so much appalling as 300 years too late. The nuns took baby A and swapped it with baby B under the noses of the attaché's wife and the Secret Service men, by the cunning expedient of wheeling one baby away. To be weighed, love, got to do that, it's the law. And wheeling another baby back a little later. The cultural attaché himself, Thaddeus J. Dowling, had been called back to Washington in a hurry a few days earlier, but he had been on the phone to Mrs. Dowling throughout the birth experience, helping her with her breathing. It didn't help that he had been talking on the other line to his investment counselor. At one point, he'd been forced to put her on hold for 20 minutes, but that was okay. Having a baby is the single most joyous co-experience that two human beings can share, and he wasn't going to miss a second of it. He'd got one of the Secret Service men to videotape it for him. Evil in general does not sleep, and therefore doesn't see why anyone else should. But Crowley liked sleep. It was one of the pleasures of the world, especially after a heavy meal. He'd slept right through most of the 19th century, for example. Not because he needed to, simply because he enjoyed it. Note, although he did have to get up in 1832 to go to the lavatory. End note. One of the pleasures of the world. Well, he'd better start really enjoying them now, while there was still time. The Bentley roared through the night, heading east. Of course, he was all in favor of Armageddon, in general terms. If anyone had asked him why he'd been spending centuries tinkering in the affairs of mankind, he'd have said, "Oh, in order to bring about Armageddon and the triumph of hell." But it was one thing to work to bring it about, and quite another for it to actually happen. Crowley had always known that he would be around when the world ended, because he was immortal and wouldn't have any alternative. But he'd hoped it would be a long way off, because he rather liked people. It was a major failing in a demon. Oh, he did his best to make their short lives miserable, because that was his job. But nothing he could think up was half as bad as the stuff they thought up themselves. They seemed to have a talent for it. It was built into the design somehow. They were born into a world that was against them in a thousand little ways, and then devoted most of their energies to making it worse. Over the years, Crowley had found it increasingly difficult to find anything demonic to do which showed up against the natural background of generalized nastiness. There had been times over the past millennium when he'd felt like sending a message back below saying, "Look, we may as well give up right now. We might as well shut down Dis and Pandemonium and everywhere and move up here. There's nothing we can do to them that they don't do themselves. And they do things we've never even thought of, often involving electrodes. They've got what we lack. They've got imagination. And electricity, of course." One of them had written it, hadn't he? "Hell is empty, and all the devils are here." Crowley had got a commendation for the Spanish Inquisition. He had been in Spain then, mainly hanging around cantinas in the nicer parts, and hadn't even known about it until the commendation arrived. He'd gone to have a look, and had come back and got drunk for a week. That Hieronymus Bosch, what a weirdo. And just when you'd think they were more malignant than ever hell could be,
they could occasionally show more grace than heaven ever dreamed of. Often the same individual was involved. It was this free will thing, of course. It was a bugger. Aziraphale had tried to explain it to him once. The whole point, he'd said, this was somewhere around 1020 when they'd first reached their little arrangement. The whole point was that when a human was good or bad, it was because they wanted to be. Whereas people like Crowley, and of course himself, were set in their ways right from the start. People couldn't become truly holy, he said, unless they also had the opportunity to be definitively wicked. Crowley had thought about this for some time, and around 1023 had said, hang on, that only works right if you start everyone off equal, okay? You can't start someone off in a muddy shack in the middle of a war zone and expect them to do as well as someone born in a castle. Ah, Aziraphale had said, that's the good bit. The lower you start, the more opportunities you have. Crowley had said, that's lunatic. No, said Aziraphale, it's ineffable. Aziraphale, the enemy, of course, but an enemy for 6,000 years now, which made him a sort of friend. Crowley reached down and picked up the car phone. Being a demon, of course, was supposed to mean you had no free will, but you couldn't hang around humans for very long without learning a thing or two. Mr. Young had not been too keen on Damien or Wormwood, or any of Sister Mary Loquacious's other suggestions, which had covered half of hell and most of the golden years of Hollywood. Well, she said finally, a little hurt, I don't think there's anything wrong with Errol or Carrie. Very nice American names, both of them. I had fancied something more, well, traditional, explained Mr. Young. We've always gone in for good, simple names in our family. Sister Mary beamed. That's right. The old names are always the best, if you ask me. A decent English name, like people had in the Bible, said Mr. Young. Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, he said speculatively. Sister Mary winced. Only they've never struck me as very good Bible names, really, Mr. Young added. They sound more like cowboys and footballers. Saul's nice, said Sister Mary, making the best of it. I don't want something too old-fashioned, said Mr. Young. Or Cain. Very modern sound, Cain, really, Sister Mary tried. Mr. Young looked doubtful. Or there's always, well, there's always Adam, said Sister Mary. That should be safe enough, she thought. Adam, said Mr. Young. It would be nice to think that the Satanist nuns had the surplus baby. Baby B, discreetly adopted. That he grew to be a normal, happy, laughing child, active and exuberant, and after that grew further to become a normal, fairly contented adult. And perhaps that's what happened. Let your mind dwell on his junior school prize for spelling, his unremarkable, although quite pleasant, time at university, his job in the payroll department of the Tadfield and Norton Building Society, his lovely wife. Possibly you would like to imagine some children and a hobby, restoring vintage motorcycles, perhaps, or breeding tropical fish. You don't want to know what could have happened to Baby B. We like your version better anyway. He probably wins prizes for his tropical fish. In a small house in Dorking, Surrey, a light was on in a bedroom window. Newton Pulsifer was 12, and thin, and bespectacled, and he should have been in bed hours ago. His mother, though, was convinced of her child's genius, and let him stay up past his bedtime to do his experiments. His current experiment was changing a plug on an ancient Bakelite radio his mother had given him to play with. He sat at what he proudly called his worktop, A battered old table covered in curls of wire, batteries, little light bulbs, and a homemade crystal set that had never worked. He hadn't managed to get the Bakelite radio working yet either, but then again, he never seemed able to get that far. Three slightly crooked model airplanes hung on cotton cords from his bedroom ceiling. Even a casual observer could have seen that they were made by someone who was both painstaking and very careful, and also no good at making model airplanes. He was hopelessly proud of all of them, even the Spitfire, where he'd made rather a mess of the wings. He pushed his glasses back up the bridge of his nose, squinted down at the plug, and put down the screwdriver. He had high hopes for it this time. He had followed all the instructions on plug changing on page 5 of the Boy's Own Book of Practical Electronics, including 101 safe and educational things to do with electricity. He had attached the correct color-coded wires to the correct pins. He checked that it was the right amperage fuse. He'd screwed it all back together. So far, no problems. He plugged it into the socket. Then he switched the socket on. Every light in the house went out. Newton beamed with pride. He was getting better. Last time he'd done it, he'd blacked out the whole of Dorking, and a man from the electric had come over and had a word with his mum. He had a burning and totally unrequited passion for things electrical. They had a computer at school, and half a dozen studious children stayed on after school doing things with punched cards. When the teacher in charge of the computer had finally acceded to Newton's pleas to be allowed to join them, Newton had only ever got to feed one little card into the machine. It had chewed it up and choked fatally on it. Newton was certain that the future was in computers, and when the future arrived, he'd be ready, in the forefront of the new technology. The future had its own ideas on this. It was all in the book. Adam, thought Mr. Young. He tried saying it, to see how it sounded. Adam. He stared down at the golden curls of the adversary, destroyer of kings, angel of the bottomless pit, great beast that is called dragon, prince of this world, father of lies, spawn of Satan, and lord of darkness. You know, he concluded after a while, I think he actually looks like an Adam. It had not been a dark and stormy night. The dark and stormy night occurred 2 days later, about 4 hours after both Mrs. Dowling and Mrs. Young and the respective babies had left the building. It was a particularly dark and stormy night, and just after midnight, as the storm reached its height, a bolt of lightning struck the convent of the Chattering Order, setting fire to the roof of the vestry. No one was badly hurt by the fire, but it went on for some hours, doing a fair amount of damage in the process. The instigator of the fire lurked on a nearby hilltop and watched the blaze. He was tall, thin, and a duke of hell. It was the last thing that needed to be done before his return to the nether regions, and he had done it. He could safely leave the rest to Crowley. Haster went home. Technically, Azrafael was a principality, but people made jokes about that these days. On the whole, neither he nor Crowley would have chosen each other's company. But they were both men, or at least men-shaped creatures, of the world, and the arrangement had worked to their advantage all this time. Besides, you grew accustomed to the only other face that had been around more or less consistently for 6 millennia. The arrangement was very simple, so simple, in fact, that it really didn't deserve the capital letter, which it had got for simply being in existence for so long. It was a sort of sensible arrangement that many isolated agents, working in awkward conditions a long way from their superiors, reach with their opposite number when they realize that they have more in common with their immediate opponents than their remote allies. It meant a tacit non-interference in certain of each other's activities. It made certain that while neither really won, also neither really lost,
and both were able to demonstrate to their masters the great strides they were making against a cunning and well-informed adversary. It meant that Crowley had been allowed to develop Manchester, while Aziraphale had a free hand in the whole of Shropshire. Crowley took Glasgow, Aziraphale had Edinburgh. Neither claimed any responsibility for Milton Keynes. Note. Note for Americans and other aliens. Milton Keynes is a new city approximately halfway between London and Birmingham. It was built to be modern, efficient, healthy, and all in all, a pleasant place to live. Many Britons find this amusing. End note. But both reported it as a success. And then, of course, it had seemed even natural that they should, as it were, hold the fort for one another whenever common sense dictated. Both were of angel stock, after all. If one was going to Hull for a quick temptation, it made sense to nip across the city and carry out a standard brief moment of divine ecstasy. It'd get done anyway, and being sensible about it gave everyone more free time and cut down on expenses. Aziraphale felt the occasional pang of guilt about this, but centuries of association with humanity was having the same effect on him as it was on Crowley, except in the other direction. Besides, the authorities didn't seem to care much who did anything, so long as it got done. Currently, what Aziraphale was doing was standing with Crowley by the duck pond in St. James Park. They were feeding the ducks. The ducks in St. James Park are so used to being fed bread by secret agents meeting clandestinely that they have developed their own Pavlovian reaction. Put a St. James Park duck in a laboratory cage and show it a picture of two men, one usually wearing a coat with a fur collar, the other something somber with a scarf, and it'll look up expectantly. The Russian cultural attaché's black bread is particularly sought after by the more discerning duck, while the head of MI9's soggy hovis with marmite is relished by the connoisseurs. Aziraphale tossed a crust to a scruffy-looking drake, which caught it and sank immediately. The angel turned to Crowley. "Really, my dear," he murmured. "Sorry," said Crowley. "I was forgetting myself." The duck bobbed angrily to the surface. "Of course, we knew something was going on," Aziraphale said. "But one somehow imagines this sort of thing happening in America. They go in for that sort of thing over there."
"It might yet do at that," said Crowley gloomily. He gazed thoughtfully across the park to the Bentley, the back wheel of which was being industriously clamped.
"Oh, yes, the American diplomat," said the angel. "Rather showy, one feels. As if Armageddon was some sort of cinematographic show that you wish to sell in as many countries as possible."
"Every country," said Crowley. "The earth and all the kingdoms thereof."
Aziraphale tossed the last scrap of bread at the ducks, who went off to pester the Bulgarian naval attaché and a furtive-looking man in a Cambridge tie, and carefully disposed of the paper bag in a waste paper bin. He turned and faced Crowley.
"We'll win, of course," he said. "You don't want that," said the demon.
"Why not, pray?"
"Listen," said Crowley desperately. "How many musicians do you think your side have got, eh? First grade, I mean."
Aziraphale looked taken aback.
"Well, I should think," he began.
"Two," said Crowley. "Elgar and Liszt. That's all. We've got the rest. Beethoven, Brahms, all the Bachs, Mozart's, the lot. Can you imagine eternity with Elgar?"
Aziraphale shut his eyes. "All too easily," he groaned.
"That's it, then," said Crowley with a gleam of triumph. He knew Aziraphale's weak spot all right. "No more compact discs. No more Albert Hall. No more Brahms. No more Glyndebourne. Just celestial harmonies all day long."
"Ineffable," Aziraphale murmured.
"Like eggs without salt, you said. Which reminds me, no salt, no eggs.
No Gravlax with dill sauce. No fascinating little restaurants where they know you. No Daily Telegraph crossword. No small antique shops. No bookshops either. No interesting old editions. No... Crowley scraped the bottom of Azrafael's barrel of interest. Regency silver snuff boxes.
But after we win, life will be better, croaked the angel.
But it won't be as interesting. Look, you know I'm right. You'd be as happy with a harp as I'd be with a pitchfork.
You know we don't play harps.
And we don't use pitchforks. I was being rhetorical. They stared at one another. Azrafael spread his elegantly manicured hands.
My people are more than happy for it to happen, you know. It's what it's all about, you see. The great final test. Flaming swords, the four horsemen, seas of blood, the whole tedious business.
He shrugged. And then, game over. Insert coin, said Crowley.
Sometimes I find your methods of expression a little difficult to follow.
I like the seas as they are. It doesn't have to happen.
You don't have to test everything to destruction just to see if you made it right.
Azrafael shrugged again.
That's ineffable wisdom for you, I'm afraid.
The angel shuddered and pulled his coat around him. Gray clouds were piling up over the city.
Let's go somewhere warm, he said.
You're asking me, said Crowley glumly. They walked in somber silence for a while.
It's not that I disagree with you, said the angel as they plodded across the grass. It's just that I'm not allowed to disobey. You know that.
Me too, said Crowley. Azrafael gave him a sidelong glance.
Oh, come now, he said. You're a demon, after all.